All right, everybody. Welcome, as always, to our panel. Today, we'll be focused on tariffs, trade, a little bit of Trump's tariff plans, and reshoring. This panel is sponsored by Tama ETFs, who manage the American Reshoring ETF, ticker RSHO. And you can actually check the post that will be pinned to the top in just a moment here to learn a lot more about their initiatives, as well as some state-by-state initiatives in reshoring as well. Those of you who have attended our panels in the past know that I like to keep things as wide open for discussion as possible. As we go along, all panelists, please feel free to chime in. If you have any 2 cents to add, drop it in the pot. I'll be more than happy to kick things around the panel as much as possible. The only request that I have is that we keep all microphones muted while others are speaking, just to avoid any overlap or audio feedback. So before responding, if you have a point to add, please just allow a small breath of air before unmuting your microphone after another speaker finishes. A little disclaimer here right at the top. As we will be discussing individual investments, it's important to note that each of your individual circumstances are different. So you need to make sure that you read about each investment carefully so that it fits your risk and return profile. Also note that nothing in this panel should be construed as actionable financial advice or a solicitation to buy or sell any security or derivative. Always conduct your own research or discuss with your licensed financial advisor before making any given investment decision. Now, with that said, I'm going to go ahead and jump right into some introductions of our panelists today. First up, Yuri Kojamirian is back again, the CIO of today's sponsor, Tama ETFs. He has over a decade of experience managing UK and global portfolios and co-managed the Magity Fund, raising several $1 billion in assets. And in previous panels, Yuri's input has been extremely insightful. Thanks once again for sponsoring our panel, Yuri, and thanks again for coming.
Thanks for having me on.
Next, we've got John Conrad, the founder and CEO of a prolific maritime and offshore website, GCaptain, a go-to source for maritime news, information, and networking. John has a font of knowledge in shipbuilding, yes, the big ones, and managed billion-dollar construction projects offshore. So he brings another unique perspective to have with us today on these topics. Thank you so much for joining, John.
I'm excited to be here. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming. I'm excited as well. Next, we've got Dr. Sal Micogliano, the chair, Department of History, Criminal Justice, and Politics at Campbell University, and an expert of maritime history. He also served as a merchant marine in a career that took him all over the world, commandeering the largest ships imaginable, and even piloting a hospital ship in the Persian Gulf at one point. You can check him out as well on his YouTube channel, What is Going On with Shipping? And I'm very excited to have his unique expertise in marine shipping and history with us today. Thank you so much for coming, Sal.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Next, we've got one of our go-to guys for some of our more macro-focused panels, Sven Heinrich, the incumbent Northman trader, one of the best chartists you can find on the web. He has a great informational newsletter, beautiful market dashboards, and he's an active guest on CNBC with the best damn trail cam footage you'll ever see on Twitter. I did see that nice, sizable, beautiful buck from this morning, Sven. How are you doing?
Hey, Nicholas. Thanks for the intro. Yeah, the buck was awesome. Obviously, looking forward to what's happening with markets here in the next few weeks with the election. And I would say my primary shipping experience is limited to bringing in the Amazon boxes that my wife orders every day, it seems. So there's that, at least.
Hey, it might even be more than I've got. Sometimes my girlfriend's the one who grabs those off the porch. Next, we've got Marko Vjegovic, the founder and CEO of Arcomino Research, where he provides in-depth research on U.S. macroeconomics and markets as a whole. Marco has nearly two decades of experience working in the markets as an equity broker, an investment advisor and manager, and even as chief bank macroeconomist. Marco's forecasts and analyses help educate and inform investors the world abroad, and we're glad to have you joining us today. Welcome, Marco.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
And we will hopefully be having one more speaker join us later on. Harry Moser, the founder of the Reshoring Initiative, focused on bringing jobs back to America and balancing the $500 billion per year trade deficit. So if he's able to get up here with us later on, I'll be very excited for his input as well. But with all of that said, everybody, let's go ahead and jump right into the thick of it. So to start us off here, Yuri, can you give our listeners today a bit of a rundown on what reshoring is and why Tima has dedicated an ETF to investment in companies with reshoring initiatives?
Absolutely. I think maybe the best way to set the scene a little bit on why we're talking about tariffs and trade policy as probably some of the most important topics discussed in this election, not just because some of the policies proposed are quite radical and have drawn a lot of attention and opinion. But I think if you sort of take a step back and you look at the U.S. economy, effectively, the U.S. has been in what you would call kind of a manufacturing stagnation for many, many years. We've lost millions of manufacturing jobs in the last 40 years, pretty much since particularly accelerating after the entry of China into the World Trade Organization. And if you look at like a very, very long spread of history, back in from the 1930s until about the 2000s, effectively industrial production in the US was growing about the same rate as GDP and consumption expenditure. And since 2000s, industrial production has basically been flat. And the result of this in the world is that America has effectively ceded manufacturing share to the world. It used to be, running in the high 20s, and now we're kind of down in the sort of 16-15% manufacturing global share. And probably the one stat I'll say that boy shocked me when I read it is that of all of the containers, which is kind of the main thing that our global economy works on, that arrive into the United States from the import partners, 75% of those leave the United States completely empty, i.e. they're shipping air. And I'm sure the shipping experts here will explain some reasons why that is, but I thought that that's quite a stark way to set things up, suggesting that that is the state of affairs that a lot of these trade policies and really the move towards reshoring, which is a very powerful trend, are here to address.
Thank you, Yuri. So there's a lot in there to unpack, and we're going to kind of go one by one through those topics that Yuri just brought up. But to kind of just really dive onto this initial topic of reshoring, Manufacturing Today recently said that, quote, the reshoring renaissance is the future of U.S. manufacturing, pointing to the shifting global landscape over the last decade. Now, if we kind of view that through the lens of an investor or a trader, I'm curious, let's go with Sven here. How do you feel about that claim? Is there just, a huge beneficial future to these reshoring initiatives that'll just massively benefit investors for domestic manufacturing?
Well, we've seen actually quite a bit of virtually unprecedented manufacturing investment over the last 2-3 years, right? Following the CHIPS Act. There's been kind of a pre-built with the tax incentives that we've seen. In terms of, further investments, that's generally a positive, right? I mean, the liquidity, I call it the overall liquidity equation that we've seen in the last few years has been actually quite counter toward what the Fed has been doing with monetary tightening, right? We've been running massive deficits, unprecedented really in a non-recessionary environment. One concern in generally I have is that maybe, economic growth as we are seeing it in terms of, the positive numbers that have been coming in may actually be somewhat overstated as a result of that. But for now, I would argue that as long as the liquidity equation remains in play, that's positive for asset prices, as we've seen. I think what is key here in terms of allocations going forward, if there's additional tariffs, how that's impacting the price equations, how it's impacting the supply demand equations, because that's actually quite a complex web to weave through. What you don't want to see is a reduction in liquidity, because that would very much negatively impact asset prices, as we've been running on positive liquidity flows for the last couple of years. So that's kind of where I'm at, generally speaking.
Thank you, Sven. Marco, from your perspective, that of an investor's perspective, do you feel the same as Sven there? Is there anything you'd like to add?
Well, I think Sven is pretty much spot on. All this onshoring thing is actually probably contributing to a bit higher inflation back home than it was prior to this process. I think that actually all of these tariffs, if they are introduced, if we get like, I don't know, 60%, 100% tariffs or whatever, well, we can actually count on prices going up more. But people tend to think that inflation will go up with more tariffs. But actually, I think that it would be more of like a one-off event. And then probably after some time, after tariffs get through, we'll probably get back to the same inflation that we had before these tariffs. Only we will settle at much higher price, of course. And this is actually what will likely happen. Prices will go up, but it's questionable whether inflation will be sustainable. Like whether we will see inflation going through or sustaining for months or a year or more than that.
Thank you, Marco. And on the next response, Marco, could you sit just a little bit closer to your phone or microphone? You were a little bit quiet during some of that.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, I will do that.
Thank you. So I kind of want to, let's just touch on that real quick then. Marco brought up the concerns around inflation, and I was going to wait a little bit longer into the panel to get into this, but that was kind of a perfect segue to touch on it right now. So let's go ahead. Because global supply chains are so interconnected, some do have that fear of inflationary response to added tariffs. And there's quite a few examples of this, even in recent history. For example, following the UK's exit from the European Union, or Brexit as it was called, the UK and the EU both faced new tariffs and customs fees. And it's widely discussed that the subsequent higher prices on imported EU goods and exported UK goods, especially in the areas of perishable and household goods, were a direct consequence of these tariffs. So my question here is, and I want to kick it around the panel just a little bit, are there any similar inflationary risks surrounding further inflated tariffs in the US on imported goods? Let's start with John here and then kick her around.
Absolutely. When we saw the real increase in inflation, it was really sparked off by the port congestion. And this is a factor that people have not really baked into the inflation equation. Been talking to Jim Bianca a lot, and he just has a thread out today saying that inflation is still persistent in basic categories. And we have supply chain disruptions around the world with the Houthis, with the Black Sea, with recent droughts in Panama Canal. Well, if you look at, the cost of shipping, how much it increases the price of Nike shoes, for example, is the one always thing. It's a very small amount, just $1 or $2. But the most volume of shipping is you know, the islets, the leases, the they're bouncing between ports around the world in order to get to the final manufacturing port. And you have the raw materials, and that requires, you know, oil. It requires bulk materials, whether it's cotton or rubber. And these ships come in and they distribute out around the world to various locations, the individual parts. And then that final shoe is created in somewhere like China or Vietnam and brought to the West Coast. Well, if there is a gap in any of those, you know, little areas before you get to the final shipping, it has this, you know, rolling downhill effect where it can increase the cost for all of the shipping companies. And then if you have instability in the market, you know, we've come from an area of decades of just-in-time shipping. And now companies from the cotton manufacturers to the eyelet and shoelace manufacturers to the actual shoe manufacturers are carrying more inventory. And that added cost is being added on to consumers. And, you know, we don't look at this when we see inflation. You know, you read in New York Times or Wall Street Journal, you have the economists come up with their reasons for inflation, and they're continually wrong over the last 2 years because they don't understand this effect of the you know, movement of goods worldwide. 90% of everything is on ships. And the good news is the Fed just last year had their first meeting at the port in New York to bring in metrics from the shipping world into the Fed calculations and give them that data for the FOMC meetings. But it's a very early stages. We're not, you know, they're not the best metrics. We don't have great data on all these movements. So it's going to take a process as the Federal Reserve and other government entities start to, you know, put these costs that into the calculations. And very quickly with tariffs, one thing we have to understand is if the tariffs, you know, are announced by Trump, as we saw the last tariff war, you know, there's likely going to be a surge of goods as they increase the warehousing and the carry costs, bring these products into the United States ahead of the tariffs. So that could be an immediate relief to inflation as there's a surge of goods that's going to wear off, you know, how long, I don't know, but it's going to wear off and then lead to a higher inflation from that.
Thank you, John. Does anyone else have anything to add to that response?
Yeah, I'll just build on what John said there. I think it's really important. When we look back at 2018, when we saw the Trump tariffs come in, what John was saying was reflected in the shipping. We saw all of a sudden a lot of shippers start front-loading their cargo in anticipation of the tariffs coming in. And I think depending on how this election goes, you can see the same thing. The precarious situation we're in today that has probably the most worry for inflation is the fact that the amount of container ships and the capacity out there right now is very finite, even though we're building new container ships because of the diversions we're doing around the Red Sea due to the Houthi. That is putting a lot of strain. We're adding an extra 2 weeks to shipments. So what we're already starting to see is shipping getting ready to start hauling cargo, for example, for the Chinese New Year. So they avoid that going in. I'll also add that in February of 2025, we're seeing a realignment of the global shipping agreements. The alliances are all about to change. And so we've been operating for the past couple of years with three large shipping alliances moving goods around. Now we're going to be in four with very different models. And that creates an unknown as we go forward in terms of how fast cargo is going to be delivered, what is the reliability of freight coming in. And the other area we're not seeing is a lot of the bulk products. Bulk carriers are a very finite number of ships out there. That commodity and the movement of grain and ore has been very much impacted here by the Houthi and the shipments. And one of the things that we've been seeing consecutively here is that ton miles, that is the amount of miles a ton of cargo is shipping, is increasing. Add to that, the age of the fleet is increasing across the board in all marks. This is creating a lot of dislocation. If you look at liquefied natural gas, for example, one of the things that we're seeing right now is a shift in the distribution and selling patterns of LNG, where LNG, for example, was the United States was a big supplier of it to China. Now what we see is a shift over to Europe because of what happened with the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And obviously that's all going to be impacted here as new policies come in, whether it's a Trump administration or a Harris administration.
Thank you, Sal and John. So I want to touch a little bit on that mention of initiatives, just kind of in general. Yuri, I'm going to pick on you for this one a little bit. A lot of pundits of reshoring point to kind of unprecedented bipartisan support to keep some manufacturing occurring here in the United States, and the over $1.85 trillion of spending and growing initiatives already underway. One of the major examples that we've already referred to today so far was the CHIPS Act. Now, on TAMA's RSHO website, there's mention of the strategic advantages that companies that move to reshore earlier than others could garner. Yuri, could you break down some of those advantages for early movers for us? And how does RSHO pick investments from amongst them?
Yeah, absolutely. I think just sort of echoing what some of the speakers said earlier, it's a really complicated picture, right? The supply chain environment. And what's quite staggering is that, yes, there was this big dislocation during COVID, but supply chains continue to be very, very stretched and under a lot of risks. You had the Red Sea, the Panama Canal, all of these things that have been mentioned. So a lot of companies that maybe during COVID time, when they would have their board meetings, would, you know, use COVID as an exceptional circumstance. I think they look at their supply chains now and their boards are telling them, listen, you really need to secure your supply chains. And so companies are starting to make these moves back to the US, which is this trend of reshoring. Now, what we're seeing as well is governments and really the government of the United States supporting this. And the tariffs and trade policy that we talk about is one element of this, which is effectively what you're trying to do is rebuild that manufacturing share that has been ceded that we lost before. And so what companies are doing is they're putting down new manufacturing capacity. It's really a boom in manufacturing construction led by computers and electronics, which is the semiconductor industry and the rebuilding of that through the CHIPS Act. But there are two other major acts that have been passed, the IIJA, the Infrastructure Act, and the IRA, which is the Inflation Reduction Act. And all of them focus on, in different ways, rebuilding and reindustrializing the US, whether it's investing in infrastructure, helping set up these factories, helping set up semiconductors. In many ways, it's about future-proofed industries as well. We're talking about electric vehicles, we're talking about batteries, we're talking about semiconductors as well. And the point is that what you're trying to do is disincentivize consumers in the US from purchasing goods that have been produced abroad and incentivizing purchase at home. And you can do that in different ways. You can do that through tariff policy by making it more expensive, but you can also do that by investing a lot and subsidizing production at home, which is what's happening. And perversely, although that takes much longer time, that actually is deflationary because you're adding extra capacity in the US. This is obviously a long-term plan. And one of the things that I'll leave you all with on this particular answer is the turn towards protectionism in the US actually started about 15 years ago. A lot of people ascribe it to the Trump tariffs and obviously those continuing under the Biden administration and the targeted national security driven efforts for protectionism. But actually it started about 15 years ago. And that means it's probably a trend that's going to continue for a long time. It's very well ingrained. And then you layer on top of that supply chain security, companies effectively are faced with a choice. Where do I build my next factory? And that choice is increasingly becoming, if you include all of the costs and risks in the equation, a better solution is just to move it closer to the consumers in the US. And so what we see, the companies we talk to, they say, well, if I build my plant in the US, I'm closer to my consumer. I have to hold less inventory, which was mentioned before, the problem. I can respond to demand better. And yes, the costs are higher, but I can use modern automation tools and set up modern factories. So the cost disadvantage isn't as bad. And especially if you look at future advancements in productivity, they could actually be, you know, on par with some of the lower cost countries in the world. Not for everything, but that is generally what we're hearing from companies. And therefore, they're making that corporate decision pushed along by governments to reshore. And this is driving a powerful multi-year mega trend, which we see.
Could not have said any of that anywhere near as well myself. Thank you, Yuri. And I kind of want to just tag a little bit more onto some points that Yuri made there. And I kind of want to get the whole panel's take here. So on that topic of productivity challenges with reshoring, some say that while productivity may diminish in that short term, after investments in technology, automation, workforce development, as Yuri was saying, that domestic productivity may actually increase in the long term. So what I want to know from everyone on the panel here, how does everybody weigh the potential for tariff-induced inflationary effects against the potential for technology-induced disinflation effects? I want to start with Marco here, and then I'm going to kick this around the panel.
Let me start from the beginning. Actually, we have the government, which is doing actions, and all of their actions are actually inflationary. The government is actually doing anything the government does is actually inflationary. Like if they do things like CHIPS Act, it's inflationary. If they do things like anything else, they're actually, if they are redistributing like income, they're practically increasing inflation. If they're making all of these onshoring activities, they're inflationary. On the other hand, the private sector works the other way. They are more on the deflationary side, and it's and at any given time, it's all about whether the government has the government's inflationary actions are more contributing to the overall inflation, or the deflationary part of private sector is more present at that time. So in my view, tariffs, even if they are increased, they're probably going to increase prices more than they are going to increase inflation. I think that there will be an increase in inflation, but this will be more like a one-off thing that will, like, it will stick, of course, because when you have the year-over-year changes, you will see this huge price spike for maybe a year or something, but you will not get, like, I don't know, a persistent 0.5, 0.6, 0.8, I don't know, 1% month over month changes. It's not like if they were to do consecutive like tariff increases, then we could probably talk about possible sustainable inflation. But if they do it like, okay, we're going to do it once, we're going to hike tariffs, we're going to increase it, I don't know, to 100% or to 50% or whatever, it will only have a one-time effect on prices. And after that, I think that we are actually going to be back to what we had so far. The overall inflation will probably stay lower after all of these tariffs are come through.
Thank you. Had a bit of an echo there. Sorry about that. So, Sven, would you agree with some of Marco's points there on, you know, any inflationary effect that may occur through these tariffs would be just kind of a temporary one and done thing, or do you see the potential for any persistent inflationary effects?
Well, this is the area of politics, global politics, that we're touching on, which brings with it inherently a lot of unpredictability, because you always risk obviously retaliatory tariffs, for example, the EU is clearly watching the election next week very closely. I think a lot of, obviously, most of the world is. But the EU is very much, for example, concerned, as is England, about more terrorists coming in. And you even heard the ECB saying they may have to respond from a monetary policy. You know, when you enact tariffs, and we saw that obviously during the Trump era, and, you know, if tariffs themselves were terrible, viewed economically, then the Biden administration, for example, would have removed them, but they really didn't. So they do serve a purpose to a certain degree. The issue is in terms of what has been proposed by Trump, for example, which, you know, we talked about, you know, obviously the headline with regards to getting rid of all income taxes. What does that imply in terms of how high would you have to raise tariffs to offset the tax revenue? Keep in mind, we're running a massive deficit as it is. And so what's lacking, obviously, at this point is visibility. If Trump, for example, were to win, what the details of such tariff levels would be. But if they become very dramatic, then you're looking at probably a very high inflationary impact. Keep in mind what you would want to do in terms of investment and building at home and so forth, and in terms of manufacturing. That's going to take a long time. That doesn't happen overnight, right? And so the inflationary impact may be quite dramatic. I think obviously the Fed and everybody else has been trying to work on lowering inflation. We're kind of gliding a little, and we have been gliding down quite a bit over the last couple of years, but we're still not at the Fed target of 2%. And as we're going into next year, we're actually looking at some base effects that will probably keep pressure up a little bit longer than the Fed would have liked to have seen. And that's before any new tariffs. So you're risking that you get into a really uncomfortable period where the market is really thirsting for further rate cuts. As you've seen this year, we've gone through multiple periods of where initially there was expectations for 7-8 rate cuts this year. Then, you know, that didn't happen. Now the Fed cut 50 basis points. But as you notice that since the last Fed meeting where they cut 50 basis points, yields have risen dramatically, you know, 60-70 basis points on the 10-year. The market has so far ignored this, but that's really not a positive in viewing what the inflationary pressures may be coming about. And with the election, obviously, and the lack of visibility in terms of what type of, you know, depending obviously who wins and what the composition is in Congress, we don't know any of this. But if there were to be larger tariffs coming, that may significantly impact the Fed's ability to cut rates. And let's face it, you know, while asset prices have rallied dramatically, especially on the fiscal stimulus equation, i.e. the big deficit, and the asset holders, top 10% or 90% of the stocks, have greatly benefited from this in terms of the wealth effect. But the higher rates that are still out there, they obviously impact the broader population. Hence, I would, for example, point out what makes this cycle so unique is that typically when you have a positive growing economy and stock markets at all-time highs, it comes with typically really strong consumer confidence. And if you look at the Michigan Consumer Sentiment Index, during big bull markets and expanding economies, you know, you look back the last 30, 40 years, typically you have consumer confidence in the 90s to 100, right? It's not until you are in a recession that obviously everything just drops to the bottom, if you will. And in this particular recovery, what's so glaring is that the Michigan Consumer Sentiment Index been hovering around the 60s and 70s. It's really low. It's actually more commensurate with recessions. What that tells me is that the broader population has been suffering dramatically from the cumulative impact of price increases. For example, housing hasn't really corrected at all, right? I mean, house prices continue to be sky high. And yields, as I mentioned just before, yields went back up quite substantially. The 30-year mortgage went back up to 7%. Fact is, housing continues to be as unaffordable as we've seen it. And so you have a big mismatch here in the economy. And I would venture to guess, going on a limb here, if we get tariffs now, even if it's a relatively short-term thing, which I can't know, because tariffs can also be just simply a negotiation tool to accomplish some other results. But, you know, if core inflation or CPI were to pick up again as a result of that, that's not going to be welcome, I would assume, by the majority of the population who are already not very confident in terms of their own financial outlook. So this is a really complex web that we're going to have to ascertain. And hence, I think the general position here is just to be cognizant that we have a very two-tiered economy running here. I'll finish off on this point. One of my larger structural criticisms for years has been that ever since the advent of permanent intervention, where policymakers have, in essence, always kind of bailed out the stock market with various intervention programs, the wealth gap has gotten larger and larger from cycle to cycle. In this last one here, following COVID, when we had just record fiscal impulse and stimulus and obviously massive QE and so forth, that got short-term alleviated by all these stimulus checks that were sent out. But in the last 2 years, you know, as asset prices have levitated, but the monetary tightening has really taken effect on smaller business and obviously the broader population, the wealth gap has gotten the most extremes we've ever seen. And frankly, one of my core concerns about this in general is that you are creating discontentment with the larger society, and I'm worried about social instability. So if we keep going on that path, and no policymakers, whether it's Congress or whether it's the Fed, has really come to grips with that, my presumption is we can't keep going on that path forever, because we're making things ever more extreme. So whatever we're saying about tax cuts or tariffs, I think anyone that's taking office here next year, they're going to have to carefully consider these issues. And I'm generally concerned that no one is, because no one's talking about it on the political front or on the monetary front. So I see a lack of leadership, frankly, on both sides of the political spectrum, and that just generally has me worried. So I'll just throw that out there.
Thank you, Sven. So I wanna touch on just a few more criticisms that are often discussed in regards to tariffs. And then after that, I'm gonna pick on Yuri some more about RSHO. So one of the main criticisms that I've come upon when kind of looking into tariffs and potentially increasing tariffs on foreign goods is that of just general strained relationships with foreign governments, as well as the potential of trade retaliation, that notion that should the U.S. make it too expensive to ship goods to and sell within America, other countries will respond in kind by imposing tariffs of their own on the United States and reducing access to foreign markets for American companies. So, Sal, I'd like your take here on how much of a concern that actually is, especially in the context of historical examples that may exist.
Well, I think you hit on a couple of key points there. Obviously, number one, we are deathly concerned. And one of the things that we've seen repeatedly throughout this cycle, especially since 2020, is the fragility of ocean shipping and the fact that you can disrupt it with just a few percentage points of trade, either up or down. And so if you're talking about retaliatory, you know, tariffs, if we're talking about imposing 100% tariff on Chinese EVs, for example, and we're concerned about how China reacts to that, yeah, we can be concerned about the tariffs, but we could be more concerned about how China orders the Chinese overseas shipping company, for example, to handle trade to the United States. You're talking about a shipping company that's owned by the Chinese government. It controls about 12 to 14% of the container ships that are out there. Just even slowing them down a couple of knots each day would cause a lot of havoc coming in and out of U.S. ports. And one of the problems you have, too, is a lot of people will look at historical analysis of how tariffs have worked in the past. And you got to remember that the volume of trade and the velocity of trade has changed so much just in the recent time. If you could go back just 25 years, Nicholas, you're talking about we were moving about 6 billion tons of cargo on the world's ocean. Today, we're moving over 12 billion tons. And it's just that sheer number that creates one of the big problems. So that if you start enacting tariffs with countries, the fear you have is that it's going to be the unintended consequences of how they impact shipping. They could be holding ships in a port. They could be imposing additional costs on it. One of the things that we've seen just recently in the diversion around the Red Sea is how ocean carriers have added surcharges onto shipments. And while we haven't seen a massive spike in inflation from that, while we haven't seen a massive spike in inflation because of the additional surcharges that are going around the Red Sea, what we have seen is a gradual increase in the overall rates. And ocean shippers right now are more cognizant than ever to keep their rates at a high level to ensure that they don't fall below what they need for making profits. And so my fear, what we have here, is that if we start a process of imposing tariffs, that we can see it have secondary effects on the shipping market, where all of a sudden shipping companies will start imposing surcharges, additional freight rates onto shipping to be able to make up for those differences. And again, we're in a period of time where we don't have a lot of excess when it comes to cargo ships out there, whether it's containers, tankers, or bulk carriers. So that if we start playing around and impacting trade, slowing trade up, or more worrying, alter trade patterns, it takes a while for ships to accommodate to the new trade patterns. You know, one of the things that people don't talk about very much is if the Red Sea diversion stops tomorrow, you're going to have massive congestion hit ports throughout Europe for several months. And, you know, I think everybody should be aware. We've seen what happened just recently with the shutdown on the Eastern Gulf Coast ports. A 3.5-day shutdown of the ports on the Eastern Gulf Coast tied up 5% of the world ships. If it had gone a week, it was going to be 10%. And, you know, we don't operate with very big margins in terms of excess shipping capacity out there. So any disruptions that are caused by tariffs has the potential to be inflationary across the board.
Thank you, Sal. John, I'd like your take there as well. What can, you know, should tariffs increase, should there be any kind of delays or any kind of holdups, any kind of backlash within the international shipping community? How do shipping companies, how do ports adapt to these types of changes?
Well, Sal's points are excellent, and I agree with every single one of them. But I also want to say it's very easy to get in the negativity and be anti-tariff and anti-Trump. And, you know, that is almost the default of the business community now. And there's a very good reason for it. And Sven said it, the complexity is the real issue. So when, you know, the last 20 years, we've had free trade, we've had reliable shipping, we've had bigger ships that just worked. The supply chains worked very well, and they were very simple. The shipping container itself is the one invention that has lifted more people out of poverty in the last 50 years than any other, because that shipping was so reliable and it was so persuasive around the world. Now, what happens with tariff is exactly what Sal says, the secondary and tertiary effects. Things start going out of whack, and what you get, And what we're already getting now with the Russian shadow fleet and movements around the Red Sea is you have a world with winners and losers. The people who can manage the complexity well far outpace the ones who cannot. And, you know, tariffs make the world more complex, but the world is already being more complex. If you went back 20 years ago, you know, when I first started studying for my MBA, everything was about simplifying the process. And there's been very little technology investment in shipping, because once you have a new trade or shipping idea and you give it to a venture capitalist, it gets complicated very, very fast. And they don't want to invest money in added complexity. But you look at someone like Elon Musk or you know, what Google and is doing, moving into a lot of industries and tying them all together. Elon with SpaceX, he's got a shipping fleet. He's got a transportation fleet. He's obviously got rocket. He's looking at the fuel inputs of this and tying it to Tesla and buying solar panels. And he is running circles around the competition because it's a spider web. He's not going down a linear path like Boeing does doing a rocket, this step, that step. He's moving around in various directions in the spider web. So, you know, if you can control that, and how do we control that with tariffs? How can we be the winners and not upset the losers? Understand that we have allies and support our allies, and it gets very complicated fast. I think the number one thing is in the entire Trump administration is the transition team. It's what quality people you can put in all of these departments, tying together Department of Commerce, Department of State, Department of Transportation. Trump has selected Howard Lutnick, the CEO of Cantor Fitzgerald. He is a web thinker. He is a man in finance who is able to think about all of these things at once. But what often gets forgotten about is this transportation component, precisely because it has been so simple and has worked for so long. But regardless if we do tariffs or not, it is breaking down now. And looking at reshoring, you have to look, what are the biggest costs for a manufacturer? That's going to determine a lot of the inflationary pressures of reshoring and the potential benefits of tariffs supercharging that reshoring. And, you know, number one cost is raw materials and components. We have excellent raw materials in the United States, but we have a lot of laws preventing, you know, the extraction of those raw materials. Components, like, you know, we said earlier, why are most of those shipping containers leaving the U.S. empty? Well, we are a manufacturer, but we're an end manufacturer. What China is they're bringing parts in and sending parts out and then coming back to the final assembly. So can we move more towards that with Allied, where we're not just building the complete John Deere tractor, but we're building the transmission again? Energy is a huge import cost. Well, you know, Trump wants to unleash that energy. Will he be successful? Labor costs, that's going to determine on can we have immigration or reform, not just low cost, but more of the skilled immigration. Everyone wants to come to the U.S. Can we harness into that, or is it going to be impossible? But finally, you know, what made United States, we're doing good with the chip manufacturer and the CHIP Act and getting those high-cost components built in the U.S., but then we have to move up the value chain from the chips to, you know, car transmissions and air conditioners and such like that. And then finally moving up to more heavy manufacturing, all the way up to shipbuilding, Sal and I's favorite. Well, as you start increasing the size and weight of those components, you are using a vaster number of raw materials into that process. And you cannot move that on trucks. We have the best trucking system in the world, but costs of trucking get very high when you start moving heavy materials. So you move it to trains, which are 1/10 the cost, but, you know, can we expand that train network? But what really made United States a manufacturing powerhouse in World War II was our inland rivers and waterways. We have we have a greater river system than the rest of the G7 combined. This is what drove down the cost of moving freight on the rivers is extremely low. Right now, moving a container is higher on the river, but that's only because of massive truck subsidies. But if we're going to reshore, if we're going to grow up the value chain, we have to invest in those rivers, the waterways, and trains, the lower cost of transportation. Otherwise, those costs are going to be put on the consumer. And unfortunately, you know, my inside look at the transition team, Howard's at DOT, is nowhere near the expertise of the transition team at Treasury. And the Democratic side just isn't looking at that. Secretary Pete Buttigieg, which I have, you know, I would give him a D minus as transportation secretary because he was given $1.2 trillion in infrastructure to fix this. And he's fixing a lot of airports and some roads and bridges, but less in trains and the ports and waterways that are essential. It is, you know, he's invested less than $1 billion, like 0.06% of this $1.2 trillion into these rivers that are going to be absolutely essential. So if Trump comes in, can they take that money that's already there, it's already with the 1.2, and rework it for the things that reshorers need to get up that value chain? And again, that gets back to the complexity. As you start moving things off highways, the costs initially are going to be expensive. You need great transportation wizards to figure out what's the best movement of trains. And the problem gets complex very quickly. So, you know, how good is that transition team?
A lot of great points there. And there's actually one kind of from the very beginning of your response that I do want to touch on, because I'm sure some of my questions might come off as a little pessimistic in a lot of ways, because we have focused quite a bit on the potential drawbacks of tariffs, the potential drawbacks of reshoring. But there is obviously some fairly sound evidence that reshoring has its benefits for American companies, as we've discussed as well. And PAMA's RSHO ETF alone kind of does demonstrate this, because as of last month, the RSHO ETF was up over 34% since inception, and despite its 0.9417 correlation with the Industrial Select Sector Spider ETF, XLI, which is a fairly high, almost perfect one-to-one correlation, RSHO has delivered around 15% in excess returns when compared to XLI. So, Yuri, kind of a two-parter here. First, do you anticipate this growth in reshoring companies to continue its trajectory as more businesses begin to adopt those policies? And then beyond that point, do you expect acceleration as time passes, maybe more government initiatives such as the CHIPS Act?
I think it's a very interesting question. Obviously, we've already seen quite strong performance from the reshoring space. I think what's generally happening, probably the best way to do it is to talk a bit about an example. As we all know, industrial companies, they're quite cyclical. They're very dependent on the economy in general. And in general, their revenues do follow the cycle of industrial production or GDP growth or whatever you will. What we're seeing when we speak to these companies is that the reshoring boom and megatrend is transforming some of these businesses. So whereas a business previously might have said, you know, we grow with industrial production and therefore we rise and fall with it, now they're saying we think our growth rates could be sort of 1 to 2 percentage points higher than industrial production. So a higher through cycle growth rate. And what that means from an investment perspective is that that business is suddenly a lot more valuable in the stock market because it's generating genuine kind of long-term organic growth, if you will, that's higher than was previously perceived. A lot of these companies, the starting point is quite low. I mean, people, you know, the market is kind of enamored with technology, and industrials have basically been left behind as a sector. If you look back 30 years or even 25 years, industrials used to be sort of 15, 16% of the market, and they hit a record low last year, about 7%. And what that's telling you is effectively, this area of the market is unloved, undervalued. And I think that's part of the explanation for the performance. And then we're seeing this reshoring driving extra growth for these companies. And those are the category of companies, not the ones we talked about before in terms of the companies that are getting a benefit. They are also part of it. But we're talking about the companies that sit around the reshoring boom. Most of the portfolio is invested in what we call reshoring facilitators and reshoring beneficiaries. And this is what was being talked about just before, is kind of the companies that are facilitating the building of the factories, the electricity grid, let's not forget, which is grossly underinvested in the US. The infrastructure around it, the roads, the railways, all of these things, the waterways as well. People probably aren't aware how bad the state of infrastructure has been in the US. The Association of Supply Chain and of Civil Engineers in America grades infrastructure every year. And for many, many years, America's been getting a grade of a D, which is pretty poor. And so all of this government funding and companies now building actual production facilities are saying we need more infrastructure, we need investment, and facilitators are helping with that. And then you have companies that are the broad beneficiaries that are benefiting from more activity happening on U.S. soil in terms of these reshoring companies. And if you put that all together, you can quickly see how suddenly you get a higher growth rate. And we think it's a very interesting area, especially for investors looking to diversify away from maybe the over-concentration in technology in the marketplace, looking for other areas of growth in maybe a less loved part of the market, your old-fashioned kind of industrial companies, you know, whether they make locks or they inspect factories or they build the rocks that you need to build highways. This is the part of the US that I think is going to really boom over the next many, many years, partly because the government is serious, the companies are serious about rebuilding capacity in the US, and we're hearing it from the companies themselves that it's all happening. A particular bellwether in the space, they sort of track the mega projects that are happening. A mega project is anything over sort of, let's call it $100 or $200 million. They actually define it as $1 billion. And what they say is only about 15% of those mega projects have even started construction. So we're very much in kind of the first innings of this story. And these businesses, they're getting the advantages, the benefits, the businesses that are helping facilitate building this and the businesses that are kind of benefiting more broadly. That's roughly how we see it playing out. And that's why we think it's quite an interesting space. And it's also a hedge in a way against all of the things we talked about, that yes, the global supply chain is an absolute miracle of really human engineering and ingenuity, but it's also quite fragile because of its efficiency. And especially as events unfold and things like tariffs come in, et cetera, you got to think, how do I have a hedge in my portfolio against that? And it's probably owning companies that are focused on the reshoring space.
Well said, Yuri. And all of this talk about, you know, the D grade, the D minus grade, I'm starting to wonder how all of you individually got a hold of my high school report cards. But moving on from that, just kind of back onto that topic of tariffs and, you know, more American manufacturing. I'm curious, and I'll pick on you for this one as well, Yuri. Should tariffs in the U.S. on imported goods indeed rise, and we do see a significant increase in U.S. manufacturing, what kind of effects could we expect to see on our neighboring countries? Like, would Canada or Mexico be exposed to any negative or positive effects from these developments?
I think as Marco was talking about earlier, it's very complicated. And I don't think economists have very, very good models to understand exactly how all of this will play out in space. I've been reading quite a lot about this topic, and effectively what you have to worry about a couple of things. The first is retaliation. So what will other countries do? Let's not forget that our neighbors, you know, in Mexico and Canada, they're under a renegotiated trade treaty that is actually up for review in 2026. So that's another interesting dynamic that comes into play. I think it's also about the elasticity of substitution. So, you know, if prices rise of imported goods, it needs to be purchased from something manufactured at home. But is there going to be substitution, or are people just simply not going to purchase the thing? A blanket tariff, which is what Trump is proposing, it's a kind of unprecedented idea in a way, but it also will probably mean that you'll put a tariff on goods that are not even produced in the US. What does that actually imply? And so there's some interesting dynamics around that. The other thing is that the United States also imports quite a lot of intermediate goods as well, which are used for the production and then exported as finished goods. And so the question is, won't that hurt exporters? And so the way I sort of think about the dynamic is it's quite complicated. Probably it's not that easy to figure out what will happen. The policy itself has an interesting idea, which is how do you rebuild US manufacturing by using all these tools? But I think the reality probably, as whoever gets into power will realize, is it's more complicated. You need to be a bit more subtle in the way of doing these things. You need to get everyone around the table and probably realize that actually the US is the greatest consumer market in the world. And it's probably unfair that it's ceded so much manufacturing share. So partners will have to pay up. And I think that's going to affect neighboring countries as well. People forget China often gets the worst finger pointed at it, but actually the trade deficits with Mexico, with Canada, with the EU have increased over time. And maybe those are going to be more pointed at than people expect, just because Trump is saying 60% tariffs on China and 10 to 20% on everybody else doesn't mean that the others aren't might get something worse. And so we, for example, variously get asked, like, what about nearshoring versus reshoring? And to be honest with you, every time I look at it, I say, I think that isn't a very sound strategy. Yes, the costs of moving manufacturing close to the US, but not into the US, are probably lower, especially in Mexico. There are so many risks attached to that still. One of them is the tariffs we discussed, but also the political situation in Mexico isn't stable. One of the companies that we own is just recently, in like a year ago, a year and a half ago, had a huge asset worth $2 billion expropriated by the government. This is a quarry and a port. And that's not really an ease of doing business situation, is it? And so we sort of say to companies or to clients that ask about this, well, it doesn't remove the risk, so why not go all the way? Yes, it's higher cost, but probably better. But I think in general, we see the direction of travel accelerating reshoring, because all of these policies are really geared to one thing, which is building and rebuilding US industrial capacity across all kinds of goods, especially the future-proofed goods. And it's about protecting US industries in this way. And it's really about understanding that building that capacity will take time. So you need to use lots of tools at your disposal to create short-term cover for these industries to build. But it's very complicated economic policy, as you can see. So who knows how it all sort of plays out. But we do think it's all positive drivers of reshoring.
And so just kind of like generally speaking, we've brought up that potential risk to the consumer following any tariff increases could, you know, dramatically inflate consumer prices. Because generally speaking, the pattern we've seen is that, you know, if a company has to pay more to relocate, to ship, to sell their goods, they tend to pass the buck on to the consumer to cover the difference. And Tom's Hardware has also reported that given the pattern by companies to pass additional costs on to consumers, laptop prices, for example, could rise as much as $350 or more from that usual MSRP price range, and other electronics by as much as a 40% increase. And so before we kind of get to closing thoughts here, I just want to levy a somewhat complicated blanket question to the panel at large here. With the risks that we've discussed in mind, with some of the benefits that we could see to American manufacturing and American company growth in-house, if you will, are Trump's takes, his proposed policies on increased tariffs at 60% on China, 10% on everyone else, is that a good idea on the surface? Let's start with Sal here, and I would like to get everybody's takes on this one.
Yeah, I mean, I come back to the idea that, you know, if you look just back to 2015, for example, the U.S. repealed the restriction on exporting crude oil. For a long time, we only exported crude oil in certain cases. And back in 2015, we were producing maybe about 500,000 barrels per day exporting. Today, we're exporting over, I think last year was 4.1 million barrels per day. So oil production is up in the United States, but at the same time, one of the things we've seen is increase in costs. because while we're exporting huge amounts of oil, what we're exporting, the light kind of sweet oil, we need to import at the same time heavy crude oil for our refineries. So I think one of the balances we have to do is not just look at the tariffs and imposing them on, but what are we doing then to incentivize the onshoring process? What are we doing to ensure that we're disincentivizing, you know, the importation, but we're incentivizing the onshore? And one of the things I fear is in 2015, when we did this with oil, for example, we really didn't have a program in place to let's start sponsoring refinery production in the United States so that we can refine our own oil, especially the lighter oil. We haven't seen a major oil refinery built in the United States since 1977, for example. And, you know, the idea of cargo preference, which is kind of a tariff in a way in U.S. shipping, where you require cargo to be hauled on U.S. ships. We've talked about it for a long time with LNG, with LPG, all those kind of raw materials that we're exporting in large degree. I think if you start imposing the tariffs, you've got to be looking at the way to incentivize it onshore. And I that's my real big take on it.
Thank you, Sal. Sven, I'd love your take here as well, and then kick it to Marco after that, especially from that point of view of an investor. Sven, can you hear me? There we go. I see him.
I'm back. I was temporarily restrained. Don't ask.
The buck got in the house,
the issue
huh?
is... The issue is visibility, and we just don't have enough details to make a true judgment call on this. And also keep in mind, again, we don't know the outcome of the election. We don't know the composition of the House and the Senate, all of which will be very important to know in order to see what actually can be implemented from both a tariff and a tax perspective. I think in principle, As I said on the outside, it comes down to liquidity. And I want to just briefly touch on this entire fiscal stimulus part of it. No matter who wins next week, and however the Congress is composed, I cannot understate how, or I cannot overstate how historic the situation is that we've gotten ourselves into in terms of what the government on the one hand is forced to on a mandatory basis, but also on the discretionary side. We're running 6 to 7% of GDP deficits. That is typically what you see in a crisis, global financial crisis. Obviously, COVID was more extreme because it was an event. Typically, they're running about 2-3%. We're way beyond that, and there is no end in sight. And so, we have no political party that stepped up and said, you know, there's something that we need to change. And the problem is, and I want this is the real funny part of all this. No one wants to change it. You know, Yellen and Powell, they've been on the record for years to say, well, these big deficits are not sustainable, yet have gotten bigger and bigger and bigger. But our entire financial system is now dependent on it, because if you now go into, if anyone even tried austerity, okay, now I'm not even talking about a balanced budget, which is just completely impossible at this point, but any type of austerity where deficits would be pared down, you're dealing with an immediate massive liquidity impact on financial assets. Financial assets, as part of the size of the economy, have gotten so large beyond anything we've ever seen. I mean, the most extreme example we have on record was following COVID, right? Because they threw out all this fiscal stimulus, all this QE, zero rates, you name it. And for the first time in history, we got to 200% market cap to GDP, which is so ridiculous vis-a-vis what we even saw during the tech bubble, 150%. Yeah, I know people say, well, we got these mega cap giants, you know, that are globally active, and maybe the norm should be higher than it used to be historically, which, by the way, was 60-80% of market cap to GDP. Fair enough. I acknowledge that point. But here we are at the end of a tightening cycle, and we're about to go into the next easing cycle, and we're back to over 200% market cap to GDP. What I'm suggesting to everyone is that globally, asset prices are so enormously large vis-a-vis the actual size of the economies, especially in the US, that if anything bad happens to them in terms of, you know, not a minor 5, 10, 15% correction, but a larger reset, that in itself would be recessionary. Why? Because consumer spending, ironically, because of the wealth gap I talked about earlier, has been driven by the wealthy consumer. The Fed itself has published a study on that. That's where the wealth gap is. This is how important this is. So if that wealth gap were to be reduced or even disappears, then you're immediately in a recession. And so I think we're in this really uncomfortable spot where neither party wants to deal with this elephant in the room. But because they're so dependent on this, and the deficits keep growing from year to year, I mean, $1.8 trillion this year, $1.6 trillion the year before. And if you look at the Congressional Budget Office, you know, it's $2 trillion plus from here on out without a recession. I mean, imagine we actually have a recession. Imagine the deficits then. And the demand and supply equation of pushing all that debt through keeps the pressure on yields, meaning you have higher rates for longer, while at the same time interest payments are exploding, have exploded to over $1.2 trillion, which is larger than the military. Absolutely absurd numbers. No one, if you told anyone this 10 years ago, no one would have believed you. Right, and for the consumer as well. I just posted a chart on my feed. You know, over $500 trillion in personal interest expenses. It's not sustainable, folks. Right. So I am concerned that without any visibility or leadership in both parties to address these issues, you know, you tweak on tariffs all you want, but there's a bigger elephant in the room. And that is going to be with us over the next few years. And unless this kind of right sizes itself, I sense there is going to be major issues at some point. But as long as you don't see any obvious negativities of this, and right now we haven't, right? Because this machine keeps going, and Yellen has been very clever and very effective in managing through the debt issuances in the last couple of years. Very, very astute how she's done that. Very clever. But it's countered the Fed's tightening effect. Okay. So I am concerned that we are, you know, while the Fed and everybody else wants to declare victory on inflation, I don't think we're there. And I think if we're going through some tariffs and some retaliatory action on the political side globally, it could make for a very, very challenging environment, especially in view that next year the debt ceiling will be real again, right? Because they had all kicked, both parties had kicked the debt ceiling into 2025. So they've been running on an unlimited credit card. So while the liquidity equation is favorable and continues to be favorable as a result of this, note the extremes in valuations and in wealth gap are getting ever wider. And that risks at some point that we're going to have a come to Jesus moment that may be triggered by something like tariffs or a political resetting. So, you know, I think we're living in, you know, it's kind of mundane to say this now, but the last 4 years, what we've all experienced, would we truly live in historic times? And I unfortunately don't see the solution being even in the forefront, because no one's even talking about the problem. Notice the Fed's never talking about fiscal stimulus. in their efforts, right? So there's a gap, and I think we're gonna all have to be confronted by that gap in the next year. It's gonna be quite interesting. That was my closing thought. Maybe not exactly on topic, but I think I wanted to just bring in the larger issue that is lurking there for both parties into the new Congress next year.
You know, I always love to have a nice little macro overview of things, Sven. Thank you. Now, before I get to Yuri and pick on him some more about RSHO, Marco, did you have any closing thoughts to that end on tariffs, reshoring in general?
Yeah, I think that Sven is actually spot on with some of his thoughts regarding the deficits, for example. At this point, nobody's talking about it. Like, the general public is not really interested in that. If you look at the surveys, what is troubling the population the most at this point, they mostly say that it's inflation, that it's, I don't know, China, that it's this, that is that, but like deficits are like, I don't know, the 10th thing on the list or the 15th thing on the list. Nobody's actually worried about the deficits at this moment. I think that this will actually change at some point when, well, it's hard to say. Maybe if something like the least trust moment happens in the US, it could be, for example, if I don't know, the bond market just decides to refrain from the demand at treasury auctions. Maybe, I don't know, the yields go up enough so that the government is actually forced to do something about all of this spending. But until that happens, actually we'll continue to see large deficits. It's regarding that, it's actually it's more of a question how much these deficits are going to contribute to the GDP. Like they were pretty big drivers of the GDP growth over the last 3 years, or say four, since the lockdowns. But going forward, I think that this effect, like marginal effect that you get from the deficits or higher spending, is probably going to wane. Like maybe we get the diminishing effect. For example, this is something that Dr. Lacey Hunt has been talking about. It's the law of diminishing returns. When you actually add more spending, this delta is actually having less and less effect on the GDP. When will that happen? Of course, it's not that easy to project, but I think that actually it will happen at some point in, I don't know, or the next year or two. We could probably see the waning effect of government spending. Then the other thing what Sven mentioned is that it's questionable whether we'll actually see all of these tariffs, because they depend on whether Trump wins, but they also depend on whether Republicans win in the Congress. Let's say that all of that happens. And let's say that Trump introduces like 60% China tariffs. And let's say that China introduces 60% tariffs towards the US as well. I don't know, there needs to be some kind of a plan there. Like, why would you use all of these tariffs unless you you want the other side to soften. Like maybe you're probably not satisfied with what they are doing at this time, at this moment, but you would like them to change their actions. Maybe if you introduce tariffs, maybe you can have a better bargaining power. Maybe you'll be able to sit down and work out your differences maybe a better way. But if tariffs are not used for that purpose, like that higher tariffs are in nature used in order to get to the world where there are no tariffs, because this is what I think the end goal should be. Because if there are no tariffs, then we can all grow more, and we can use the global trade better. And if that's not the end goal, then I don't know, at some point things might break up on either side. Like if they introduce 60% tariff back, maybe the US consumers just say, okay, we're not going to use this product anymore, or all of this group of products, because they become too expensive for them, or whatever. Maybe they will just concentrate on some other products, and in the end, maybe this will lead to possibly lower consumption, because people can actually in the end they can refrain from any non-essential products if they become too expensive for them. So I think that it's sort of like any other prices. Like if you have high prices, at some point there will be a breaking point where consumers just say, okay, I'm not going to buy that anymore, and I'm going to switch to some other product. And if that happens, we can actually see the reverse of inflation, or possibly deflation at that point. So obviously there are a lot of things that can influence all of that. For me, it's all about, okay, if you're going to use the tariffs game, maybe you just use it more in a way that you get a better negotiating power, and less in a way that you want to start a tariff war or whatever with other countries. Because that obviously any kind of tariff war will not be welcomed by either side, because this is not like what will be beneficial for either side here. And that's why I think these things should be more used in a way of tactical approach to some negotiations, and maybe less in a form of let's say just doing it because you want to hurt the other side, because the end goal should be that both sides gain, and not that one side gains and the other side loses or whatever, because in the end it all depends on that.
You know, I think that makes a lot of sense there, Marco, and I think I speak for all consumers the world abroad when I say that it would be ideal if countries could maintain a really strong air of cooperation in terms of commerce. John, before I get us back to Yuri and RSHO, did you have any closing thoughts or additions to what the other panelists have said?
Absolutely. This is an excellent panel, and thank you so much for inviting me. So much to talk about, and you know, I wrote like four major takeaways, you know, and I think the number one is the amount of complexity, and whether we do tariffs that increase complexity or we just go down the road that we're on right now with more Houthi involvement, Russia, China, you know, the world's getting more complex. So the key thing, again, is Howard Lutnick's transition team or whoever, Harris, if she wins, we need really smart people in government, in businesses, in order to navigate all these secondary and tertiary effects of the geopolitics and tariffs and such. And, you know, the danger there is when you get the smartest people in the room, they can make the biggest problems. Look at Enron. So, you know, where those problems typically happen, and I wrote the book on the Deepwater Horizon explosion, so big complex, the BP oil rig explosion in the Gulf, where the complexity really happens is when you have a bunch of linear thinkers who don't see the full picture. So we need not only very smart people, but we need people specifically who are web thinkers, can think in that complexity. And over the last 20 years, those people were at a disadvantage. You know, the autistic Elons and Sergey Brins and those types didn't get really promoted in companies because, you know, the profitability was linear, and our government is very linear. And these linear thinking ways are hitting up against geopolitics and world trade, and that's causing major problems. Second, real quickly, massive investments. Ellen, you know, we were a mass importer 10, 15 years ago of oil. That changed, but it was with fracking, and we know it's fracking, but there were massive investments in that fracking. How do you do those massive investments, as Sven said, with problems with expanding the money supply and spending? Transportation, again, if you look at, you know, we do some things like the airline travel is we do very, very well, even though the airports are a mess. Trucking, we do fairly well. Trains were doing horribly. Ships and waterways were absolutely failing. We don't even realize that the Army Corps of Engineers, it's the Army who's doing our waterways, and the Army is more focused on war and trade or Ukraine right now. So they're failing us. And when you think about these transition teams, we put our B and C players in transportation and some of these other things, which are becoming a lot more important now. So can we refocus on kind of those boring subjects? And finally, you know, none of this is successful. You can be the best web thinker with unlimited money and great transportation, as Elon Musk has. But what's Elon Musk's number one problem right now? It is the red tape, the bureaucracy. So you can either, we're moving from this era of attrition warfare, where it was a big company going right down the center of very simple A to B to C, and raking in profits. And now with this complexity, it is advantaging the smaller teams that can move around the enemy, what the Marine Corps calls maneuver warfare. Well, in order to do that, you have to have leaders that allow those smaller teams freedom to move. And smaller teams cannot move right now because of the regulatory state. So how well Trump can really cut the red tape is going to be absolutely critical for reshoring and maneuvering around tariffs in these other countries, especially China, which controls so much. You know, they control ships, they control ports, they control lodging data solutions. So that's a major advantage. It can be a disadvantage if we can be nimble, but the regulations won't let us. And finally, you know, the thing that, you know, in these financial podcasts and such that we forget about is the power of the Pentagon, and the power, you know, has a real influence. And the Pentagon's mainly controlled by Army people who are stuck in the global war on terror, Iran, Afghanistan. And those advisors are not just in the Pentagon, they're in the Senate. You know, Jack Reed at West Point, or you have Mike Pompeo was the Secretary of State under Trump, West Point, or you have all these West Point thinkers, but they're very influential. And I'll tell you right now that, you know, I'm a trade, GCAM's trade, maritime trade, but a large percentage, over 50% of my time in the last year, 2 years, has been on the war, Black Sea, Red Sea, grain movements. It all comes back to this war. And when I go to these Pentagon briefings, when I'm going to the think tanks, they are all talking about a war with China. Whether you believe that or not, you know, doesn't matter. But you have to start reading these journals because these people are very influential behind the scenes in the White House, State Department, and all these things. And they are moving, and they're moving to protect the U.S. A lot of this reshoring is a push by the military to get the supply chains back here because they are very confident that the geopolitical tensions are going to ramp up, and they are very, very worried about a war with China.
Thank you very much, John, for that additional insight. So I want to spin here back to URI and RSHO. Again, like I mentioned earlier, looking at kind of other ETFs in similar spaces, industrial, XLI is the main one that comes to mind. And again, RSHO has delivered around 15% in excess returns when compared to that ETF. And so, URI, if you could, for the listeners today, just kind of give some more insight to how Tama's RSHO is kind of navigating this changing global landscape, how you guys are looking to the future of reshoring to just kind of continue expanding upon the success that you've seen so far, and maybe a little bit on where some of our listeners today can find a little bit more information about what's going on over there at Tama.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the RSHO fund is probably it's the only one in the market focused on this space purely, and we think that that's important. It's managed by a manager who spent sort of 30 years investing in industrials and these kinds of companies over many market cycles and different political landscapes. So he's seen quite a lot. I think one of the things that I'll probably highlight is where we're seeing interesting opportunities, where more of the fund is in the sort of facilitator bucket that I mentioned earlier. We're in the early stages of reshoring. We're building a lot of these factories. People probably aren't aware, but there really is a manufacturing boom going on, and that in terms of manufacturing construction. And so we're in those facilitators that are helping build those factories early on, and a lot of less so in the beneficiaries, because all of those things will come later in terms of more activity in the US. One area that we're looking at quite carefully as well, and again, that's not investment advice, is something that was touched on earlier in the discussion, is about pharmaceutical ingredients. Actually, US supply of pharmaceutical ingredients is actually dangerously reliant on foreign suppliers. As currently there's a Biosecure Act, which is working its way, I believe, through the Senate and Congress. And the idea here is to try to create more security around the supply of important materials for the biotechnology chain, as we've seen in COVID. I remember reading a stat, but it's something like 80% or even 90% of generic active pharmaceutical ingredients in America have no U.S. source of supply, which is very dangerous. And so we were looking very carefully at that area, and we have made some investments there, which I think is very interesting. And that also speaks to the broadening out of this reshoring. It's not just focused on industrial companies. It's really, as we progress, we build the factories, and then the second stage is the beneficiaries and these other sectors. So it's going to become maybe a broader fund than people are aware of. So not just an industrials focused play. The second thing is just what we're hearing from the companies. It's earnings season right now. We're talking to a lot of them. What they're saying is activity is not booming, actually, in terms of the economy. I think things are stable, not getting worse, not getting better. As you all know, the ISM, which measures kind of economic activity in terms of purchasing managers, is not exactly screaming that there is a bull market or that there's very strong economic growth. But the companies are saying a lot of what's happening is people are waiting for the results of the election to see what happens. So I think next week is going to be interesting in terms of the fundamentals of companies, whether it has an effect on markets, I don't know. I think that is also what we're hearing from the companies. They say once the election's out the way, interest rate trajectory seems to be set, we should start to see a reacceleration, hopefully, in some of these orders and growth, and we're positioning for that. And then the reshoring story, as I said, very much in the early innings. We're just getting started, and a lot of the companies we invest in are really well positioned for this, this long-term trend. So yeah, and then for people who want to find out more, you can always head to our website. We produce a lot of materials on the space. We've recently written articles about reshoring examples in particular states. So we looked at comparing nearshoring to reshoring. There's a lot of presentation, infographics, and charts just sort of really telling the story of these major acts and what's going on in rebuilding U.S. industrial capacity. So yeah, you can always head to TEMA ETFs, TEMAETFs.com. And there you just look up the RSHO page or insights and you can find lots of information about the fund and the things that we write about.
Absolutely do that, folks. And just for the sake of ease to the listeners, up here in the nest of the panel is actually one of those very articles that Yuri just mentioned about reshoring. And that article that's pinned there, it breaks down state-by-state initiatives. It breaks down full investment statistics for these initiatives. Really good source of information across the board on TEMA's website. They have numerous ETFs across numerous industries. A lot of expertise, work, and research goes into what they do. So thank you again, Yuri, for sponsoring this panel. These are really important topics that I think anybody interested in investing in the market should at the very least be privy to. And thanks again, of course, to all of our panelists for being here to lend your input and your expertise. And with all of that said, I hope all of you have a great rest of your day. If you came in late, don't worry about it. This will be released later today on Spotify, Apple, and YouTube as a podcast episode. And we'll see you all in the next one. Take care, everybody.